We're very honored to be able to screen tonight's film, The Narrow Frame of Midnight. The title of the film comes from Walter Benjamin's The Origin of the German Mourning Play, in which Benjamin discusses the appropriateness of setting dramatic action at nighttime. Some of you may know this book, but this is the passage from which the title of the film comes from. He says, "There's a good reason for associating the dramatic action with night, especially midnight. It lies in the widespread notion that at this hour, time stands still like the tongue of a scale. Now, since fate, itself the true order of eternal recurrence, can only be called temporal in an inauthentic, that is, parasitical sense, its manifestations seek out time, space. They stand in the narrow frame of midnight, an opening in the passage of time, in which the same ghostly image constantly reappears," end quote. Evoking the experience of a kind of temporal limbo, a displacement in time and space, a moment in which time seems to stand still long enough to permit us to glimpse into the darkness of experience, what Ernst Bloch once called the darkness of the lived moment, and into the uncertainties into which we always find ourselves, but find ourselves as the ones who are always looking to find ourselves. The film charts the journeys, as Aaron said, of several characters as they struggle to find their place in the world. A young orphan, Aicha, is found alone in the forests of central Morocco. She has a past that reveals a courageous attempt at self-determination. Taken in soul from her home in the Atlas Mountains, Aicha finds herself at the mercy of Abbas, a petty criminal, and his girlfriend Nadia. They cross paths with Zakaria, a Moroccan-Iraqi writer who has left everything behind, including a troubled relationship with Judith, a teacher, to follow in the path of and search for his missing brother. The group embarks on a journey that will lead them from Morocco to Istanbul, across the plains of Kurdistan and beyond. The paths of these characters intersect at different points in the film, and though each of their destinies eventually diverge, they are connected in profound ways. The arc of each respective journey reflects and informs the circuit of the other journeys. Three of the characters are people who are searching. They're explorers who at different points decide to take the leap and embark on a voyage whose end is unknown. Of Moroccan and Iraqi heritage, Tala Hadid, who, as Aaron said, is here with us, at the moment off to the side in this little dark room over here, another little narrow frame. Her films have screened at film festivals around the world, including Berlin and Venice, and have been shown, among other venues, at the MoMA and Lincoln Center in New York City, the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis, the Cinémathèque Française in Paris, the National Museum of Women and the Arts in Washington, D.C., the Los Angeles County Museum, and the Photographers Gallery in London. Her films have received numerous awards, including a short film Oscar from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And in 2013, the fine art photography publisher Stern published a volume of a selection of her photographs from her project, Heterotopia. I trust you will enjoy this evening's film. We're going to be very happy to welcome Tala in a little bit. I think she might remain hidden at the moment. You're welcome to come out and at least say hi. She's going to watch the film with us. We'll screen the film, enjoy the film, and then afterwards she'll come out and have a discussion with all of us. Okay? Enjoy the film. Maybe you could just begin by talking about how the project started, how you conceived it, how you cast the characters, how you made the film, and just tell them a little story, a little background of the film. I think that might be a way to begin.
Okay. I was living in New York, and then 9/11 happened. And then soon after 9/11, my father's Iraqi, but even if he wasn't, he was exiled, and my relationship to Iraq was through him. But even if I wasn't Iraqi, there was 9/11, and then very soon afterwards, Iraq emerged very quickly, and then the war, etc. So some of these characters, especially the main character, Zakaria, had existed in different stories that I'd written before, And he reappeared like a phantom, actually through the years. And I'd started to write the script for this film just after, basically after the beginning and the build-up to the war. And through the drafts, it went on for a few years because we were assembling funds, which was just as well because the war landscape kept changing. And it was difficult to really have a grasp as just a witness like all of us what exactly was going on even up until today, not just in Iraq or Syria, you know, all the tragedy of the last, you know, 15 years, maybe a bit less. So the script was an ongoing thing that continued into a film that continued to be a sort of ongoing process, even for me now, but maybe we can discuss that for another time. So then filming, the characters, I really wanted, it was very difficult to me, for me, first, probably maybe you see this in the film, to write a narrative, like a classical narrative. I really wanted to break that. And for the actors, I also really wanted to look for people who were a mix of actors and non-actors, and even if they were actors, people who maybe had similar experiences to the characters on the page and in the film. So like the main actor, Khaled Abdallah, the Egyptian actor, I had initially met him and I thought he was wrong for the role because he was not broken, not too soft. He'd had a sort of comfortable life, not his own fault, but you know, he was going along. And then because the film took so long to make, it was 8 years, in the middle of this, Egypt, Tahrir, and he's Egyptian, but he lived in England, he went to Egypt, he moved to Egypt before the revolution. So his whole experience radically changed as a person, so when he came to play the role, there was a sort of symmetry between what was going on with his life and the role that he had to play in the film. And so I was searching for people who were close to the kind of people that I wanted in this film, not so much to play roles. The Iraqis and the group of boys in Istanbul are refugees, they're not actors, they're like refugees who had newly arrived, like they had been in Turkey for 6 months. And so there's a mix of actors and non-actors in the film.
I mean, I wonder if you could, I really love the title, of course, because it does come from Benjamin, and I was thinking about this as I was watching the film. It's not just, you know, in the passage itself from the Benjamin, which comes from Benjamin's book on the German morning play. So it's a book that is very much about ruins, corpses. I mean, these figures appear continuously within the book. Sort of ruins, corpses, the violence that has taken place and has left its traces in landscapes. And there's a passage, in fact, that I was thinking about when I was watching the film again. There's a point where Benjamin cites a Baroque playwright, and he says that he's looking at the landscape, the devastation, the wars, the plagues, and he talks about the way in which he hopes that he will be forgiven in some way in the midst of all this devastation for creating his own paper graveyard in some way, which I've always found an exquisitely beautiful passage. And there is a way in which, I mean, in the, as one's watching this film, because he goes to the morgue, there are the corpses, there is the history of the violence in the landscape and the reference to the long history going back all the way to the Mughals in the 13th century, so that it is an area that has, at least in terms of the references and so on, it's haunted by innumerable histories of loss, displacement, devastation. And I was wondering if you can identify in some way with this request for forgiveness in creating a film about this. I mean, that gesture, which I find kind of, right, that he has to make the gesture. He has to make this paper graveyard. And one can talk about film and photography as mediums, as filmic paper graveyards. Does that resonate for you in any way?
It absolutely resonates. I mean, what you're saying now moves me deeply to hear you say it. And Benjamin, of course, was a huge influence, not just for this film, but it was like a period of time I was reading a lot of Benjamin. Sorry, but your question to me was, do I feel, does what you said resonate with what
you want,
say? No, it resonates a great deal.
I mean, it's almost like because how one represents something. How is it possible within the medium of film to represent that history of loss and dispossession and exile and so on? And,
yes.
And there's always this sense that, I mean, is one able to capture it or not capture it? And if one cannot capture it, then there is this sense of doing it, but asking for a kind of forgiveness.
Yeah, and I never thought about it that way, and I like I like this idea of asking for forgiveness, because I'm not sure that it is representable. I mean, I'm not sure that you can, you know, in an image, it is a paper graveyard. Mm-hmm. How can you really approach something like this? Not just because of the length of, let's say, a sort of repeated sort of historical tragedy in the case of Iraq or the region, but, you know, even a shorter history is very difficult to approach in an image or in a film. And I didn't want to tell a story, if that makes sense. I had been asked by my producers, you know, you when is this, and the fall of Saddam, and, you know, very specific dates and events. And I was like, well, I'm not sure, because I would really like to get to sort of something that's hidden in what is going on, that it's that's there, but that's sort of invisible. I don't want to ground it in a story or an A plus B equals C type of structure, which is a wager. I mean, it's a risk to do that in a film. But I instinctively thought that this was the way to approach what was going on. And to a certain extent, the echo continues past the film. It's not just about the film. The strangely, some of the scenes in the film, like the morgue scene, you know, the film came out and then traveled for a few years, you know, for a while. And that scene was seen very, you know, it was always changing. It was like a sort of strange crystal ball in relation to what was going on. I mean, so many things have happened in the last few years, but like the morgue scene could have been suddenly in Syria, you know, or Egyptians sometimes would, it was just constantly shifting. It wasn't just a morgue, a makeshift morgue in Baghdad. You know, there's an openness and strangeness and a suspended reality in that. And coming back to the production, you know, we were like, should we go and film in Baghdad? And when we were filming, it was kind of dangerous. But, you know, you could do it, but you'd have to do it with a small crew and a small camera and running around. And I was like, well, I would rather that the Iraq scenes be hallucinatory, like a descent into sort of hell and not quite real. So I needed equipment and staging. So I was like, then we actually filmed in Morocco, because going, though of course we really discussed this with everyone, like I really wanted to go, but it would have meant not the real, but sort of a type of image that is documentary or not so strange and dreamlike. But I wandered away from Benjamin. There was also the Paul Klee.
Yes, yes.
About the angel.
The angel of history.
The angel of history. I mean, and that very short passage really had a huge effect resonated a lot. It was maybe you could describe it more eloquently than me.
I don't know if I remember, but it's he's talking about a storm that is blowing from paradise, and he has this figure of he takes this Paul Klee image of an angel, which looks like a kind of lion's face with scrolls and hair and little bird wings and little bird feet. And it's Paul Klee's angel of history, the Angelus Novus. And Benjamin reads it as an angel that is being blown by the storm from paradise. And he has his back toward...
he's got the back toward the future.
Toward the future. So he can't see the future, but he's moved in it. What he's witnessing as he's being blown toward the future is a pile of debris and
destruction,
ruins.
Destruction. Yeah.
It's a destruction. And it's a. I was thinking of the passage too. It was a very beautiful passage.
But that had a huge effect. You know, I kept thinking about like how.
One is blown into the future and witnessing the devastation behind. I mean, there is something that just to encourage you to elaborate a little more just in terms of the title, because you have this passage from the Trashville book too, but it's where he's talking about this narrow frame of midnight in which all the manifestations of fate, mm-hmm. of what comes through and moves, the forces that are larger than us that move us in different directions, and how they manifest themselves in this little narrow frame of midnight, which is this opening onto a passage of time, and how in this moment there's sort of the recurrence of different ghostly images. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the hauntedness of all these characters. Right, every character is haunted by a sense of loss and displacement, and a sense that they're not present with themselves in some way, outside of the relations of those losses. And I thought about it again when he puts on the music. He puts a little cassette, and then of course it's the night lengthens, and the wound knows its time. Mm. Right, so the night extends, it continues, it almost doesn't end. And the wound knows its time, because that is its time, like the lengthening of the night, because the wound itself gets extended. It comes to recognize its time in the lengthening of night, because it's almost as if one could say that wound, which you're documenting in these different ways, each character has been wounded in some way. There's no historical, there's no after to historical trauma.
No.
Right. There's no after. So that with him, with Joseph, Aisha with her mother, Judith with whatever relation she had had with different people. There's no after.
I mean, night lengthens essentially.
Night lengthens.
I mean, I think with the actor, we always till now, we always refer to certain moments. We always just say midnight, like certain sort of key moments. I mean, even for him in Egypt,
right.
Of like, you know, I always also thought or took that idea from Benjamin to also think that this sort of narrow frame of midnight was also a time where everything is possible, where time actually stands still.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time where there are ghostly figures, there's also some sort of strange opening, or it's this sort of doorway through the which the Messiah slips through.
Right.
So at the same time, it's something else as well. Like there's a possibility in that.
Well, the possibility is a tomorrow.
Right? Is a tomorrow.
The midnight, it moves to the next day. So it's the possibility, the hope for a tomorrow that wouldn't be simply a repetition of the past.
Exactly.
Maybe you could say something, because I liked that, you know, there are all these different personal relations that take place. And okay, the Asia develops a relation with Zachariah.
Mm-hmm.
There's the hint of the relation with him and Judith. I mean, so, but all these, let's say, more personal, intimate relations that develop or get hinted at or get evoked are, of course, taking place in a, let's say, a landscape, in a series of spaces or places that bear the traces of much larger histories, right? Mm-hmm. So that maybe you could say something about how you perceive the relationship between personal history and longer historical periods, right? Because that seems to be an important part of what you're saying, that somebody's identity is linked in some way to the history that comes before and traverses
yes.
them.
I mean, I can basically maybe speak about it in terms of whether it worked or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like how to try and to do that in a film or in an image. Mm-hmm. Because yes, there are the personal relationship, but for me what was very important was precisely these sort of wider spaces, mm-hmm. wider histories. And I'm not, you know, sometimes I watch the film and I'm like, okay, did I, it's a very risky thing mm-hmm. because the relationships are so, meaning between the characters, barely there, they're very fragile and at the same time there's this sort of expanse, mm-hmm. the spaces that they're in, mm-hmm. wider world, which was where landscape was very important for me, the spaces where Judith lives. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, sorry, now I'm going off on a tangent, Judith was meant to be in France. Mm. There was a whole section of the script where they crossed Europe. Mm-hmm. And then there were sort of various constraints, so I had to flip it mm-hmm. and make it in Morocco. But it mm-hmm. essentially was the same. Mm-hmm. Meaning where she lived. So I had these Judith's place, Zachariah's slightly different, but he still crosses these landscapes mm-hmm. in Iraq, Judith, like when he goes to her house. So mm-hmm. I basically, when I was preparing the film, I had that very, I think, difficult balance mm-hmm. between where does the personal...
Yeah.
relation, how do you make a connection in a film mm-hmm. not with the word, you know, if I mm-hmm. were to write an essay mm-hmm. maybe it would be not easier, it would be different, but how can you do that in a film, how can you do that with a moving mm-hmm. image mm-hmm. how can you show the echo between the yeah. personal yeah. relation and the wider mm-hmm. the wider histories.
I mean, I like that you say that because I also was thinking that the landscape is so important, you know. So, in fact, you know, the other line, it's not just the night lengthens, but Nietzsche said the desert grows, right? So there's mm-hmm. this way in which this gets linked in some way. But the landscape almost becomes as much a character in the film as the characters themselves. And you have that beautiful opening with Asha leaning against the trees in the forest and referencing the trees as her mother in some way and saying that they want to send her away. But there's this identification between persons and trees with which the film opens in some way.
Yeah, like nature. And that yeah. was something, I think, in any case with the cinematographer, we were like, how can we have this sense of, like, you know, very close and very far. In fact, mm-hmm. the cinematographer, we're coming back to just silly yeah. stories of like, it's too wide. And I was like, no, we really have to have a sense of the landscape, of space, mm-hmm. of how small we are mm-hmm. in the vastness of, you know, whether it's a city mm-hmm. or a forest or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, the digital print was quite dark, so I'm not yeah. sure if you saw in the forest, like, we tried to have a sense of her close to the tree in the forest, but then she's flying.
Yeah.
And the sort of here she is in this space, like, that transcends her, that beyond her. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, they are, all the characters are living through trauma, but also sort of guests passing through.
Yeah. yeah.
All of them, even Judith.
Right, right.
So.
I mean, there is that early scene with Hindi Zara, mm-hmm. as the character who Zachariah stays with one mm-hmm. night, and he forgets. I mean, there is the forgotten watch. There's the alarm clock that's in the pool. You know,
these sort of
lost markers or measures
of time.
But if I remember the line right, I mean, she talks about the ruin of the city. And then talks about the necessity of
still standing.
To remain standing yeah. in the midst of the ruin, mm-hmm. which I found very strong in the sense of what's, you know, especially in relation to what comes after. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say
Yeah, I really, I had told, I'd written that character, and I told she's not an actress, she's a singer, mm-hmm. a friend. And I was like, I really, in explaining to her how I wanted her to deliver these lines or to speak this, is that she was almost like, not an oracle, but she was standing mm-hmm. at some doorway to give him succor and strength. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, here is the destruction, you have to go on. Mm-hmm. It is what she says to him when they're
right.
in bed.
Right.
The fact that she picks her up, that's unimportant, you know, maybe she's a prostitute, that actually was not it, like I'm not sure, I hope that it came through, but when I had told her, I was like, you are like the oracle, you mm-hmm. know, he's going to pass through you mm-hmm. before he starts this journey, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's come to you, and this is what you tell him, and that's a really... really mm-hmm. important line for the whole film,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. No, I experienced it that way, I think. No. I mean, you know, it's a political film. Right? Mm. You know, there's a I mean, I register it as a political film. And you even situated it in relation to the history that, let's say, began in quotation marks with 9/11 and so on. And I think that one of the things, as someone who was living in New York at the moment of 9/11 and afterwards, what one saw all the time in those immediate months were efforts to tell the story, to singularize every single person who had died in the bombing. And what you never saw were singular deaths in Afghanistan and other places. And so that, you know, I think one of the forceful elements of the film is that it actually documents in some way or suggests in some way the impact of that history of devastation and violence on singular people,
mm-hmm.
right? So that you on the lives of people, the consequences of it. Can you say something about what compelled you in some way to make the film? I mean, what you want everyone to take away from the film?
Even for me, I mean, I think, and I hope, I think that the scene in the, you know, let's say the scene in the morgue, which is apart from the prayer, is, you know, I wanted to place the dead in this, it's a morgue. It's not that it's in a sacred space, mm-hmm. that somehow that, you know, that the bodies, when he's moving through, that we would just place the dead in their sacred space, because there've been so many, I mean, I don't know, the numbers are like astounding. And I think, you know, the last few years, the time, anyway, when I was preparing the film, when I was writing it, I had a sense, I don't really know, I know a bit, we only know fragments. Mm-hmm. And so this, it wasn't just an outrage, there was outrage mm-hmm. as the years went on. I mean, we moved beyond 9/11 to what's going on, there's this war, and then as it went on, something is hidden outside of the frame of what we're seeing mm-hmm. of the war. It's not just about the bodies anymore, but something else, like even now, we don't really have a grasp on the level of the destruction. Mm-hmm. I think recently, last year, or a year and a half ago, you know, suddenly there was this, for me, like, there was this drone footage that mm-hmm. came out over, I think, Homs, one of the cities, a few of the cities in Syria, and it's astounding. It's just shocking. It's like Dresden. There's nothing. Flattened. Mm-hmm. And so this thing echoes, I mean, it continues mm-hmm. on now. Mm-hmm. Like in Europe, you know, I was in Amsterdam at a documentary film festival, and a lot of the films at the festival obviously were about the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. And not just about the refugees, but also the countries they're passing through and people's reactions. And really, people have no idea that these people have come out, so many people have come out of a flattened, destroyed landscape. So somewhere in the film, I wanted to place the dead in a place, in the space where they would be sort of respected. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense. I wanted them to be in their sacred space. Mm-hmm. because they haven't been accorded that, you know, not just in the West. Obviously, there in Iraq or Syria, it's a, you know, these raging wars, there hasn't been, but everywhere else, they haven't been accorded their, their due, basically. Yeah. So I that was always something for me in the preparation, the years of preparation of the film, that was at the core of the film. Mm-hmm. Then Zakaria, crossing the destruction, is essentially, you know, I don't think there is anyone from the region, and everybody has different experiences, obviously, who does not feel that they're sort of emerging or crossing the rubble, you know, in so many countries. And so, you know, the film ends and then, you know, it continues on.
Right, right, right.
So,
I mean, I remember thinking in the first Gulf War that the one line that the elder Bush said that was absolutely true was that this was not a war against the Iraqi people. And I always thought that the reason it was true is not because of what he was himself thinking he was saying, but because it was never a war against the Iraqi people, because it was always a war against tropes of the Iraqi people.
Exactly.
Because they didn't know anything about Iraq. They couldn't. They wouldn't know a single Iraqi philosopher, poet, musician, filmmaker. They wouldn't be able to name. They had no sense of the culture. And so this giving an opening or a sense of what is there, I think, is extremely important.
So. And I think when you say like a political film, apart from the narrow frame of Midnight, you know, I always think for myself anyway. How difficult, you know, what is a, I would like Pasolini, for example, and Pasolini always was like, had written, I'm not sure which essay, whether it was an interview, had mentioned, had been talking about the political in cinema, and, you know, that it doesn't always have to be something that's sort of overtly obvious, like this is a political film, and, you know, sort of modeled on a sort of reportage, very real. That is political. I'm not saying it's a form of a political cinema that doesn't, because there's a long history of very good documentaries and even fiction films that are like openly political. But you know, I was wondering, like, how can you approach it maybe in a different way? Right. What does the political in the image mean, or in cinema mean?
Right.
And how can you construct something with a different approach?
Because it's extremely poetic, the film, so I think it invites you to think about the relationship between cinema, poetry, and politics in some way, too.
Yeah. And, you know, beyond this, like, I wonder how images resonate within us. You know, like, we watch a film and, you know, I was on a jury recently and they were like, we should discuss every day what we've seen. I was like, well, no, because you watch a film and it enters into you and it sort of expands and it, for me anyway, it can take 3 days, a week.
Yeah.
You know, you have an internal relationship with it and you have to let it sit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I keep thinking, you know, how can you, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, how can you make a film thinking in that way? You know, how do films continue to unfold once the last image has cut to black? Mm-hmm. You know, it continues to have a relationship within the spectator. And continues to unfold and exist.
Maybe we can open it up and invite questions from the audience. And Aaron will give you a mic.
Thank you. Thank you for the film. Very, very powerful. I have two questions. The morgue scene, the location, it looks, there were some big hooks. Is that a slaughterhouse?
Yes.
Ouch. The second question is this. There's something in the language, cinematographic language, the pacing of the film, the importance of the relation of the characters with their surroundings, and not so much of these actual details of the script, the silences. Remind me a lot of Eric Frommer. Is that an important influence?
I like Roma, yes. But
it really remind me a lot of his films.
Yeah. Not he isn't, but I love, I mean, I like his films a lot. There are lots of others who, I didn't actually, do you want to know who they are? Or do you want to know what
I want to know what you think.
For filmmakers
Yes.
Two things. When I was making this film, I actually stopped watching films for about 6 years. It was long, and maybe it was even longer. It was only when I wanted to really specifically watch something that I would go and, you know, search for it. But I didn't watch films, I just read. Theory or poetry, like it was just mainly literature. I don't know why, I just couldn't, I just didn't watch. And then 2 years after I finished the film, I started watching. Now I'm watching like a lot, you know, I might stop again. But in Roma I do like a lot, but I like Russian, I like the Japanese film, Mitsuguchi, I don't know, the Russians, Parajano, I don't know, I like lots of different film. You know, you have different filmmakers who in different periods of your life, like different novelists that you read a book, you know, it means something at a certain period. Maybe it'll last for 30 years. Tarkovsky, obviously, Klimov, I don't know. I like the Russians and the Japanese filmmakers a lot.
It felt a lot like that, like his films, the silences, the conversations with oneself, the importance of the surrounding, immediate surroundings, how the character relates to that. Yes. Remind me a lot of him.
Well, that's a massive compliment. Thank you. Please, thank you.
Well, you told us about the journey, what it was all about. Now I understand what he was up to, what he's journeying to or for. What about the symbolism? The circles, some writing or graffiti, some rectangular forms, houses, of course, that I understand that. But what about the circles?
Which ones?
Aisha is drawing circles.
When she draws on the... When she draws?
And she's twirling something around at one point.
I don't know. Well, you know, I'm not sure, but
just
I
being a child, okay.
No, but actually something strange does happen in a film, and I really think this, maybe any, you know, certain ways of working, that there's also an invisible writing that happens when you work on something. It's really strange. So when the project is finished, you're watching it. Even a few years afterwards, I'm like surprised because there's a strange kind of weird hidden logic. Something's happening. The organization of, let's say, of making a film. There's a hidden organization and there's a hidden writing to it. I'm not sure about the circles, but the fact that you saw them means something. That they're there, you know. Really, I don't say this lightly, you know, that there are certain things that are there, that exist, that keep repeating, and I'm not sure that they were, if it was just me or the group of us, when I say the group of us, the collaborators, you know, we work very intensely together for months, you know, imagining things, and things come out in films, you know, everything that the camera captures, you saw circles, are really there, or various repetitions that come up in various sequences. What I'm saying is I watch films sometimes, or films that I've made, and I was like, oh, that's amazing. You know, not that the film is amazing, but that like that I see that this writing has taken place that was invisible, hidden to me as I was doing it. Now I trust it more with the projects that I'm aware that it also takes place, and that there are connections that are being made that you're not aware of necessarily when you're writing or you're filming or you're collaborating with your collaborators, but it's, you know.
I mean, for me, there was if one thinks of something circular, there's the very sort of exquisitely beautiful scene when Aishi is in the room of Judah's house, and you have the twirl, and for me, I mean, my association is the opening of Swan's Way with Proust. I mean, his parents put a magic lantern in his bedroom, to presumably animate the room and keep him company. And he's totally freaked with this thing that comes into the room and rotates and sends light and defamiliarizes his room. Because Proust always thinks that change is entirely overrated. But it's a totally cinematic scene. And if I remember right, the magic lantern Proust actually references a kind of Bengali tiger. And there is
those tigers are.
Yeah, in the thing, yeah. So this is in the Proust, it's a kind of cinematic, is there a figure for cinema in some way.
But you know, in films, and I'm sure, you know, maybe you've come to a few of these discussions with filmmakers, you know, there's so many, you know, you have these lots of different people, and again, the specific collaborators. The art designer is a visual artist, nothing to do with film. And I was like, I really want you to work on this. And she's like, but I know nothing about film. I'm like, don't worry about that, because I know that we'll be able to have a conversation that will be fruitful. And so you have all these different people, and we're discussing things like childhood.
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean? So there's that Proustian element, or the circles, or a magical. Mm-hmm. Like for months, we're discussing these things, and we're gathering objects, and we're building a set, and we're talking to I'm talking to the little girl, and placing her. So there are all these things happening, especially in a fiction film, which is you're using the false to sort of create something. Hopefully, if you're lucky. That's the real. It's like a citadel of the false, of like mass, lots of technical crews and lights and all of that, just to create maybe sort of a moment, if you're lucky, of the real, and so, you know, it pops up in scenes.
Yeah, I was wondering in the context of your having said that about the woman who is a sort of raisonneur figure who says you have to remain upstanding and so on, whether you could comment on the other gender relations in the film, because there's quite a lot of quests that seem to involve women in some way, or stasis that seems to involve women in some way, which seems to cut across the notion of the quest that I would say whose end point, quote unquote, never comes or is always deferred and changed for the male figure. But because there are so many women, and because they have very straightforward roles, let's say conventional in certain ways, except for either the child or strangely the image, as you know, because we were just talking about that, of the women. The covered women, the women in black, so to speak, with the pictures of their loved ones that overwhelm the screen in a kind of pattern at that very end. But just the gender, you know, you speak about the plot, you know, the plots that were intersecting and your care with plots that were not conventional. Could you just comment a little bit more?
Well, in terms of the women, I mean, I'll come to that in a moment. I had always wanted, when you mentioned the young girl, that I wanted, Aisha is her name, for her to be the only one who, in a way, is not as destroyed as the others. Mm-hmm. That it's only her, maybe because she's but also because of who she is, that is not Judith or the girlfriend, Nadia, of, you know, the man who kidnaps her. But in terms of the women, I always... They are there, because there's the girlfriend and Judith, but I always only ever thought that the young girl was the one who was not as fragmented and as lost as the others, that she would be the only one. In terms of the women at the end, I wasn't quite sure of your question.
Sorry.
The women in
because they in many ways have the most they're most conventional visually for what we understand, and at the same time
the women in black?
Their intense agency in seeking, you know, some sort of mutual confirmation or witnessing is quite interesting as an image of what's going on in the film. Yeah, mm. With the pictures and just moving forward, but in a space that's quite empty. Mm-hmm. That was a very, very striking image. But I'm just interested in how you figured the agency of the women in the film, of whom the girl Aisha has the most agency, actually, in some way. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to be honest. Like when I was writing it, I didn't think of it in that way. Like the only thing I thought of was the only person who the closest to having agency is the young girl, mm-hmm. And the others are swept up in their lives and what's going on. The women in black are Iraqi women, probably in the south in Basra. They're missing and they're dead.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask a short question and I'll expand a little bit. So what could we do, and I guess this is a question for maybe all three of you, what could we do, what could you do as a director to have this film reach a broader audience? So, okay, you did the difficult job of creating a masterpiece. How could we make this, you know, reach more people? Because partly the statement, the political statement. It's also the poetry that's in there. There are the images, and from this series that we had from the latest three films, I think this is beautiful. What could the director do after and the entire crew to reach a broader audience? Why isn't this shown to a lot, you know, lots more people than just, you know, the group that were here? I think it would be very important for other people to see this film than just us over here.
Well, I mean, you're asking a fundamental question about film production, which it's very difficult for films. Lots of different forms to have visibility because of the system, the film system, which is dominated by money, you know. So it's like big budget films, you know, these like Marvel comic, that's what works now. So even like independent conventional classical films are like battling to have distribution. It's very difficult to have distribution, and it's becoming very difficult to make, films in a certain bracket. You know, you can go and make a film. You know, the film I made after this one, I made for nothing, and by chance it sort of slipped through and was shown, or had distribution. But it's very difficult. Distribution kills a lot of very good films that are made. You know, it's a marketplace, and it's a tough one. You know, distribution of the companies. You know, the companies that will buy your films and distribute them. And do they think they're going to make money? Like, you know, this film is not going to make money. So it's, that's the end of it. Except for, you know, it has a life. No, not just festivals. It has a life. And it depends on how brave distributors will actually go ahead and, you know, distribute it. Or, you know, it'll be screened in like, and it has been like in different countries. And it depends. There's their networks and... But generally speaking, it's very tough. It's very tough because it's media and it's entertainment, and there's like dominant. You know, we can get into other. This topic actually is very important because it also affects the type of films that are being made. A certain way of looking at the world. You know, there's a dominant way of looking. There's a dominant way of telling stories, which is fine. And I think there's room at the table. Of different ways of looking, but you know, it's very competitive, and it's a marketplace, and it's a brutal one, you know. But times have changed in the last 20, meaning that it's not to harken back. Oh, it was a different time, but in terms of distribution, you know, up until probably the 80s, you know, there were risks that were taken, where you know films. You know, this is not like a 6-hour film, mm-hmm. a 10-hour film will, you know, come out in a big cinema. You know, and there are like 10-hour films being made now that are amazing, you know, like Wang Bing. Or, you know, there are lots of filmmakers who are doing things that are challenging and that a wider audience might find difficult. But, you know, things have become very tough because even before, you know, there were some cinema owners that would risk, they can't do it now because they just can't survive. You know, you're not going to play a 10-hour film on, you know, I don't know, like, torture camps in China. You know what I mean? It's tough. It's tough. And if you're talking about big cinemas where, and cinemas are barely like alive now anyway, you know, because of streaming and watching films, you know, on your computer, whatever. So it's a changed landscape. And there's a battle for cinemas. I'm not sure, you know, hopefully they'll continue to thrive, and I'm talking about even the art cinemas, and stay open. But it's just, it's money.
But I actually find it, I like that you said it was a difficult film to watch.
Excruciating.
Because
it is.
But I, you know, because I sometimes, I'm a professor, I teach sometimes what I consider to be difficult books, and the students are dying reading the book, you know, and I'll say, but it's no more nor less difficult reading this book than living a life. Because living a life is not an easy thing to do. And sometimes students think that especially, because they don't think that their lives are that difficult. But I think that it's actually, it's important to watch these films. I mean, one of the reasons that we're collaboration with Louverture Films right now is because Louverture Films is a production company that makes these films, that supports this kind of filmmaking. Mm. And it's a kind of extraordinary venture. And we have felt very lucky to be able to present these films. And actually, I hope that you'll continue to come to the rest of them in spring.
But you know, Eduardo talked about Louverture. And this is the kind of, you know, Louverture is a production company. And, you know, the producer, Jocelyn Barnes, you know, I was telling her, you know, it's really for filmmakers. It's not just about producing a film and finding you money, but it's a support and it's a lifeline. Mm-hmm. And you can also, and it becomes like a family, very different, because mm-hmm. Louverture produces very different films. But always with, you know, I think that especially Jocelyn, you know, has an idea of, you know, what does it mean to sort of, you know, to support films that maybe might jolt your way of thinking, mm-hmm. might reposition your way of looking, to think differently. You know, once you sort of submit, this is the good thing about watching films together collectively, mm-hmm. is that when the lights go down, we're all together. Yeah, you know, especially if you, well, this is a free screening, but if you buy a ticket after 15 minutes, if it's bad, you can be like, okay, forget it, I'm leaving. But generally speaking, you know, I find audiences, and even me as a spectator, are generous, are ready to look in a different way. You know, I remember the first screening. One of the screenings for this film, the audience, it was a big theatre. I think it was even in Toronto. And there were all these different people, you know, like very different people. It was packed. And I was like, and then afterwards, I was so happy. I was like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. So many different people are willing to watch a difficult film. And they stayed with it. And then afterwards, I was really depressed because I was like, but this is amazing. The audience is there. But then we can't because there's a wall. You're not, you know, because actually we are not allowed to watch certain types of films. You know, we have to go and search for them in the cinematheque or the art cinema or whatever, or screenings like here, you know, because I don't think this, my experience as a filmmaker is I think that the people who put the money in, you know, the marketplace is like, oh no, there's a kind of, it's not that there's a contempt for the spectator, but sort of like, they can only see this way of, they can only see this type of film and this way of looking at the world. Well, actually, no, we're very flexible.